Word of mouth.
Coming up on Word of Mouth, Joan Didion from Writers on a New England Stage, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. The author of The Year of Magical Thinking reads from her latest book, Blue Nights, a memoir about love, aging, and the insurmountable grief of losing a child. After decades of observing the pain of others, Didion grapples with herself. She reflects on her role as a mother, talks about what gets revealed when writing about loss, and about the ruthless nature of her trade.
What I meant when I said that writers are always selling somebody out is that nobody wants to be written about in the end. Nobody wants to be interpreted by somebody else.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Joan Didion interprets herself on Writers on a New England Stage. Coming up next on Word of Mouth. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, Writers on a New England Stage with Joan Didion, one of America's most admired writers, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Slouching Towards Bethlehem, her 1968 collection of nonfiction established Didion as a brilliant observer and a powerful voice in the genre that would become new journalism. She's since published 5 novels, a play, and several collections of essays, including The White Album, Political Fictions, and other chronicles of moral and political disintegration. Didion and her husband, John Gregory Dunn, became a shining example of a successful literary couple, whether co-writing Hollywood screenplays or editing each other's work. They were nearly inseparable for 40 years. Her life exuded accomplishment and privilege until late 2005, when she was broadsided by loss. After visiting their daughter, Quintana, who lay in an induced coma in an ICU, Dunn, Didion's collaborator and confidant, died of a massive coronary while sitting at the dinner table in their New York apartment. The Year of Magical Thinking was Didion's narrative response to his death and to a series of cascading illnesses suffered by her daughter. It was by far her best-selling book. Just after The Year of Magical Thinking was published, Didion's 39-year-old daughter died of acute pneumonia. Joan Didion's most recent book, Blue Nights, is an intensely personal memoir of Quintana's life, mental illness, and then death. Blue Nights is also an occasionally self-lacerating questioning of Didion's role as a mother and her grappling with aging. She writes about her fear of falling and of her own frailty, which was apparent as she was escorted on stage at the Music Hall to read from Blue Nights.
In certain latitudes, there comes a span of time approaching and following the summer solstice, some weeks in all, when the twilights turn long and blue. This period of the blue nights does not occur in subtropical California, where I live for much of the time I will be talking about here, and where the end of daylight is fast and lost in the blaze of the dropping sun. But it does occur in New York, where I now live. You notice it first as April ends and May begins, a change in the season. Not exactly a warming, in fact, not at all a warming. Yet suddenly summer seems near, a possibility, even a promise. It's that time of year right now, in case you noticed. You pass a window, you walk to Central Park, you find yourself swimming in the color blue. The actual light is blue, and over the course of an hour or so, this blue deepens, becomes more intense even as it darkens and fades, approximates finally the blue of the glass on a clear day at Chartres, or the Cherenkov radiation thrown off by the fuel rods in the pools of nuclear reactors. The French called this time of day l'heure bleue. To the English, it was the gloaming. The very word gloaming reverberates, echoes, the gloaming, the glimmer, the glitter, the glamour, carrying in its consonants the images of houses shuttering, gardens darkening, grass-lined rivers slipping through the shadows. During the blue nights, you think the end of day will never come. As the blue nights draw to a close, and they will, and they do, you experience an actual chill, an apprehension of illness at the moment you first notice. The blue light is going. The days are already shorter. The summer is gone. This book is called Blue Nights because at the time I began it, I found my mind turning increasingly to illness, to the end of promise, the dwindling of the days, the inevitability of the fading of the dying of the brightness. Blue nights are the opposite of the dying of the brightness, but they are also its warning. Today would be your wedding anniversary. 7 years ago today, we took the leis from the florist boxes and shook the water in which they were packed onto the grass outside the Cathedral of St. John the Divine on Amsterdam Avenue. The white peacock spread his fan, the organ sounded. She wove white stephanotis into the thick braid that hung down her back. She dropped a tulle veil over her head, and the stephanotis loosened and fell. The plumeria blossom tattooed just below her shoulder showed through the veil. "Let's do it," she whispered. The little girls in leis and pale dresses skipped down the aisle and walked behind her up to the high altar. After all the words had been said, the little girls followed her out the front doors of the cathedral and around past the peacocks, the two iridescent green and blue peacocks, the one white peacock, to the cathedral house. There were cucumber and watercress sandwiches, a peach-colored cake from Paillard, pink champagne, her choices all, sentimental choices, things she remembered. I remembered them too. When she said she wanted cucumber and watercress sandwiches at her wedding, I remembered her laying out plates of cucumber and watercress sandwiches on the tables we had set up around the swimming pool for her 16th birthday lunch. When she said she wanted leis in place of bouquets at her wedding, I remembered her at 3 or 4 or 5 getting off a plane at Bradley Field in Hartford, wearing the leis she had been given when she left Honolulu the night before. The temperature in Connecticut that morning was 6 degrees below zero, and she had no coat. She had been wearing no coat when we left Los Angeles for Honolulu. We had not expected to go on to Hartford, but she had seen no problem. Children with leis don't wear coats, she advised me. Sentimental choices. On the day of that wedding, she got all her sentimental choices but one. She had wanted the little girls to go barefoot in the cathedral. Memory of Malibu. She was always barefoot in Malibu. She always had splinters from the redwood deck. Splinters from the deck and from tar from the beach and iodine for the scratches from the nails on the stairs in between. But the little girls had new shoes for the occasion and wanted to wear them. The stephanotis. Was that another sentimental choice? Did she remember the stephanotis? Is that why she wanted it? Is that why she wove it into her braid? At the house in Brentwood in which we lived from 1978 until 1988, a house so determinedly conventional, 2 stories, center hall plan, shuttered windows, and a sitting room off every bedroom, as to seem in situ idiosyncratic. There was stephanotis growing outside the terrace doors. I would brush the waxy flowers when I went out to the garden. Outside the same doors, there were beds of lavender and also mint. A tangle of mint made moist by a dripping faucet. We moved into that house the summer she was about to start the 7th grade in what was then still the Westlake School for Girls in Holmby Hills. This was like yesterday. We moved out of that house the year she was about to graduate from Barnard. This too was like yesterday. The stephanotis and mint were dead by then, killed when the man who was buying the house insisted that we rid it of termites by tenning it and pumping in Vicaine. At the time this buyer bid on the house, he sent word via the brokers, apparently by way of closing the deal, that he wanted the house because he could see his daughter marrying in the garden. This was 5 weeks before he required us to pump in the Vicaine that killed the stephanotis, killed the mint, and also killed the pink magnolia. The termites, I was quite sure, would come back. The pink magnolia, I was also quite sure, would not. The last time I saw the house in Brentwood Park before its title changed hands, we stood outside watching a three-level Allied van pull away and turn onto Marlborough Street. Everything we then owned, including a Volvo station wagon, already inside and on its way to New York. After the van moved out of sight, we walked through the empty house and out across the terrace, a goodbye moment, rendered less tender by the lingering reek of Vicane in the house and the stiff brown leaves where the pink magnolia had been. I smelled Vicane even in New York every time I unpacked a carton. The next time I was in Los Angeles and drove past the house, it was gone, a teardown, replaced a year or two later by a house marginally larger, a new room over the garage, an additional foot or two, and a kitchen already large enough to accommodate a square Chikrin grand piano, but lacking for me the resolute conventionality of the original. John always said we moved back to New York. I never did. Brentwood Park was then, New York was now. Brentwood Park before the Vicane had been a time, a period, a decade, during which everything seemed to connect. There had been cars, a swimming pool, a garden. There had been agapanthus, lilies of the Nile, intensely blue starbursts that floated on long stalks. There had been English chintzes, chinoiserie toile. There had been a Bouvier de Flandre, motionless on the stair landing, one eye open, on guard. Time passes, memory fades, memory conforms to what we think we remember. Even memory of the stephanotis in her braid, even memory of the plumeria tattoo showing through the veil. It is horrible to see oneself without children, Napoleon Bonaparte said. What greater grief can there be for mortals than to see their children dead? Euripides said. When we talk about mortality, we are talking about our children. I said that. When we talk about mortality, we are talking about our children. I just said that, but what does it mean? All right, of course I can track it. Of course you can track it. Another way of acknowledging that our children are hostages to fortune. But when we talk about our children, what are we saying? Are we saying what it meant to us to have them? What it meant to us not to have them? What it meant to let them go? Are we talking about the enigma of pledging ourselves to protect the unprotectable? About the whole puzzle of being a parent? Time passes. Of course it does. It's a banality. Of course time passes. Then why do I say it? Why have I already said it more than once? Have I been saying it without hearing what I say? Could it be that I'm hearing it more this way? Time passes, but not so aggressively that anyone notices. Or even, time passes, but not for me. Could it be that I did not figure in either the general nature or the permanence of the slowing, the irreversible changes in mind and body? The way in which you wake one summer morning less resilient than you were, and by Christmas find your ability to mobilize gone, atrophied, no longer extant. The way in which you live most of your life in California and then you don't. The way in which your awareness of this passing time, this permanent slowing, this vanishing resilience multiplies, metastasizes, becomes your very life. Time passes. Could it be that I never believed it? Did I believe the blue nights would last forever?
Joan Didion reading from her memoir, Blue Nights, about the Brentwood, California home that she, her husband, and daughter Quintana left behind when they moved to New York. After a break, we'll get to know a little bit more about Quintana's charm and her fears. And we'll also hear about Joan Didion's hapless beginnings as a mother. Stay with us for more Writers on a New England Stage with Joan Didion when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, Joan Didion from Writers on a New England Stage, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Joan Didion's new memoir, Blue Nights, recalls the short and troubled life of Quintana Roo, the daughter she adopted with her late husband, John Gregory Dunn. It's also about facing her own physical decline. Blue Nights and the Year of Magical Thinking are heartsick, vulnerable, and painfully human books from a writer who is famously remote. Here's how Boris Kachka describes speaking with her for New York Magazine. Reading Joan Didion on any subject is like tiptoeing across a just-frozen pond filled with beautiful sharks, he wrote. You look down and pray the ice will hold. Meeting her is not a vastly different experience. Thank you, Joan.
Well, thank you.
Beautiful to hear that again. It's wonderful to have you here. And a beautiful book after a remarkable book about your husband, The Year of Magical Thinking. But it strikes me, you said that you hadn't planned on having children, and suddenly it came upon you that you wanted to have a child.
Oh, well, I'd always wanted to have a child, but I didn't. None came my way.
So when you decided to adopt, you write about getting the bassinet from Saks and the cashmere receiving blanket, silk-lined. But what did you know about becoming a mother?
I knew nothing. I knew not one thing, which became clear to me quite soon.
How did that become clear to you?
Well, I thought I had it all covered because my mother said she would come down and show me how to wash, sterilize the bottles. And she did. And that was the extent of her knowledge of how to take care of a baby. So we, together, my mother and I, managed to raise a child, Quintana, who had perfectly clean bottles, but not much. We hadn't given her much else.
Well, you also dressed her beautifully.
We dressed her very well, yes.
It was like, you write in the book, it was like you had a doll.
Yeah, I'm afraid it was.
Well, when did she become a child to you? When did that transform? Were you conscious of that?
She must have been in high school. I mean, she was definitely past babyhood.
Well, you write in the book that, you know, you started to realize when she was five, she started writing these. She wrote a fantastic little poem, and a little later on, a novel.
Just she wrote to show a novel, you. Yes.
Just to show you.
Just to show me, yeah. What she was going to show me, I have no idea.
But you write that she was already a person. I could never afford to see that. What was the cost there? What couldn't you afford to see?
I couldn't afford to see that she was no longer a baby. That she was not forever controllable baby.
Yeah. Her own person.
Her own person.
Yeah. There's something else you write about, the dizzying alternations of infancy and sophistication that she expressed.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of those.
She was, when I say they were dizzying, I never knew where she was in the scheme of things, because she would suddenly... You would be talking to her, and suddenly she would start talking about something so grown up and sophisticated.
Like movie reviews, I remember you
yeah, talk. Or the kinds of sound you needed what you needed in your projection room to accommodate. She had a doll's house, for example, that had a projection room. Now, she had never been in anyone's private projection room. I mean, some people we knew in Hollywood mm-hmm. obviously had them, yeah. Right? But she had never, to my knowledge, ever been in one. But she had somehow picked up that they existed, and they had Dolby sound.
Well, there are some other things you write about her. What was it, calling 20th Century Fox and asking, you know, what does it take to be a star?
Yeah, she did do that. A lot of things that that in retrospect were a little strange, uh-huh. You know, and maybe I should have worried.
Well, Well, that's part of what you begin to look
wonder.
At in this book.
Yes.
You know, you wonder about these kind of, what do you call them, the quicksilver changes in her mood.
Well, I certainly started worrying about those when the quicksilver changes started being mentioned by doctors.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You and John were very clear from her from the beginning that she had been adopted, and you kind of came up with a narrative for her about making that choice. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's the basic narrative that every adoptive parent believes is the right thing to tell the baby. It's the chosen child scenario, which is believed by adults to have some magic that will get the adopted baby past the difficulty of realizing that, there's a dark side of adoption which we don't like to think about, which is it's hard for a child to know that if somebody chose you, then somebody else didn't choose you.
And she would ask you, she would say, what if you hadn't been home when Dr. Watson called?
Right.
You know, what if there had been an accident?
Mm-hmm.
So she was aware of this that it was random on some level.
Yes.
Yeah. And was that something you tried to, as you said, to protect the unprotectable? Was that something you tried to protect her from?
Well, yes, of course, but I tried to protect her from it by ignoring it. You know, that was my usual way of trying to protect somebody. Ignore what might be bothering them.
Is that so?
It certainly is.
Well, it's hard to imagine because you're a writer who I think has stood in for so many of us in, you know, touring through disaster zones on some level in public and private life and noticing and observing what goes on with other people. Was it too close to do it with your child?
Well, yes.
Yeah.
It certainly was.
As she grew older, did you ever talk about the choice narrative or this broken man she spoke of?
Well, the broken man was just a fear. I mean, it was a childhood fear, which finally became real to everybody in the family because she was so fixed on the idea that there was a broken man coming in her room at night. Well, I began to believe it.
How'd she describe the broken man?
If I were to tell you her exact description of the broken man, you would come away convinced that he existed and worked in a gas station. Because he had that kind of shirt. I think it was Texaco, but it was the name of a gas.
Mm-hmm.
So it was seen by her in her imagination.
Right. So you were frightened by the broken man.
I was frightened by the broken man.
But he went away somehow.
The broken man we outgrew. Yeah.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.
Joan Didion recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. When we return, she'll talk about living with loss, selling herself out, and not knowing whether she'll ever get to the other side of grief. Stay with us for Writers on a New England Stage with Joan Didion when Word of Mouth continues.
It's the saddest experience you'll ever know. Because one is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. One is the loneliest number that you'll ever know. It's just no good anymore since you went away. Now I spend my time just making rhymes of yesterday. Because one is the loneliest number that you'll ever do.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. Today, Writers on a New England Stage with Joan Didion, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Before the break, Didion spoke about her early experiences with motherhood after the adoption of her daughter, Quintana, and what could have been the signs of mental illness that would trouble Quintana throughout her adult life. In Didion's new memoir, Blue Nights, she reflects on her daughter's life and dares to grapple with painfully human questions about whether she was a good enough parent to Quintana, on how to be left behind, and how to accept one's own decline. Joan Didion has famously said, "I don't know what I think until I write it down." She also said that writing The Year of Magical Thinking was her way of grieving her husband. I wondered how that process was different, or what was revealed to her while writing the memoir, Blue Nights.
Magical thinking was about somebody who had come through an experience and come out the other side. Mm-hmm. Blue Nights is about somebody who hasn't yet come through and isn't at all sure that he or she is going to come through.
Was it more difficult to write?
Yeah, much more difficult.
Right. Because you're in it.
Well, I was not only in it, I didn't know the end to it.
And now?
Well, I don't know the end to it still, right. But I know that. But I know I don't know it.
But you felt after The Year of Magical Thinking that you had come through.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
There was a book about coming through. I mean, magical thinking was entirely about surviving an experience. This was about not necessarily surviving an experience.
And I think aging also, it becomes
that's the experience
very
that
much
you
about
may not
you aging.
Survive naturally.
A lot of people are asking about this process of writing and how it connected to grief for you. And ask, do you recommend writing as a catharsis for grief? Has it helped you after writing your last two books?
I don't recommend grief for anything. I mean, I don't think it's very useful. The fact that I spent a lot of time was because it came my way. I didn't spend time with grief because I thought it was
a great topic.
A great topic, yeah.
But, you know, now The Year of Magical Thinking was your best-selling book to date, so a lot of people came to know you through this grief.
And I came to know them.
How so?
Well, I mean, after the book was published, people would very often stop me and talk to me about people in their family who had died or about their own experiences with grief.
But do people also feel compelled to advise you about how to treat grief?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They feel that I spend far too much time with it and it's time to move on now. Well, welcome to it.
Or as Quintana, I said to you, I believe, don't dwell.
Don't dwell on it.
Don't dwell on it.
Right.
Just move on.
Yes.
Do you find it hard to separate your personal life from the press, particularly since your subject matter has been so personal in the past two memoirs?
No, I don't find it hard to separate my personal life because I've always separated my personal life.
People are wondering about faith for you after experiencing these two deaths. I have a couple questions here about, did you have any faith? Did you discover faith?
I went into this at some length in the play based on The Year of Magical Thinking. A big question in the play is faith. How has this changed your approach to faith? Well, it didn't change my approach to faith. My approach to faith remained exactly the same, which was that it was always, well, it was based on the litany. If there were certain words in it, I believed it.
So did you have a concept of what happens to people after they die? Did that, was ever?
No, that was not part of, yeah. No, after people die, they die. I mean, as far as I was concerned, they're dead.
Did you wish for faith at any point?
I mean, I didn't wish for people to walk out of the wings alive, if that's what you mean.
No, I mean, you know, a lot of people say, well, my faith gave me great comfort after
no,
the death.
No, my faith never came to me in that personal way.
A lot of questions about your writing and how you began to write. Where do you find the courage to write, and when did you decide that you were a writer?
I decided that I was a writer when I was a very small child, and my mother She gave me a notebook and advised me to, instead of whining about being bored, to write something, and then I'm going to be bored.
So words became a way that you found meaning in the world?
Words were a way that I found meaning in the world.
Mm-hmm. Words are something that you always relied upon to make sense of the world. And what do you do when things don't make sense anymore?
There was nothing that didn't make sense about John's dying. It made perfect sense. Everything did not make perfect sense to me about Quintana's dying. But that was because she was much younger.
Yeah.
John had a heart condition that he had been told for many years would eventually kill him. So I was the only person surprised. That was my failing, not anybody else's.
I was thinking about you writing in Blue Nights about the production of The Year of Magical Thinking, the stage production that Vanessa Redgrave starred in. You really loved being there at the theater. Or you write about it, that you really enjoyed it, that they set up a Cafe Didion in the back to make sure that you ate.
Yeah, well actually I was at the Westport Playhouse last night, and they had one too, which was very sweet.
But while this play was running, she could still be alive.
She could still be alive. Yeah.
I wonder if now, having written a number of screenplays with your husband, are you thinking about turning it into a film? Has anybody optioned it?
I'm not.
It's not something you do?
No.
Here's a sweet one. One of the images I truly identify with is in Why I Write, when you talk about objects shimmering. Can you talk more about the way that you see the world? It seems to coincide with your descriptions of light in the opening of your new book.
Oh, that's very nice.
It is.
The shimmer that is mentioned there was something I wrote about a long time ago. And it was seeing a shimmer around the edges of things, which I guess you could also see in the Blue Nights.
A similar, continued question. Blue Nights is a myriad of styles, part Fitzgerald, glittery summer nights, part Ginsberg, repetitive lists of punctuated pain. Is the style intentional, and if so, to what end?
The style is always intentional. I think, at some level. I mean, obviously you work it out so that it doesn't just appear on the page. It's intentional in that you have worked it out.
And there are some mantras that sort of continue over and over again in this book.
Well, they continue over and over again in everything I write, or in everything anybody writes. I mean, everybody has their own mantras.
I'm a 33-year-old writer. If you could give yourself any piece of advice at 33, what would it be?
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Here's a question. Do you still think that journalists are always betraying someone? I think maybe this is a reference to...
Writers are always telling somebody out.
Exactly, from slouching toward Bethlehem.
Yeah, which never was meant exactly the way it has been taken. What I meant when I said that writers are always telling somebody out is that nobody wants to be written about in the end. Nobody wants to be interpreted by somebody else. You don't see yourself exactly the way somebody, even if somebody else adores you and thinks you're wonderful and expresses that in every possible way on the page. Being written about is not a good experience still, because it's always going to be somebody there on the page who is not the way you see yourself exactly. It's the way somebody else sees you. So that's what I meant by writers are always selling somebody out.
How about this experience now that you've written Where I Was From, The Year of Magical Thinking, and this book, Blue Nights. How about yourself as subject?
I totally sold myself out in all of those books, particularly in Where I Was From.
What do you want to write about now?
I'm not sure. I mean, I still have to figure that out.
Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right. It's all right. Here comes the sun.
Joan Didion from Writers on a New England Stage, recorded live in front of an audience at the Portsmouth Music Hall. When we return, more conversation with Didion and more of her responses to questions from the audience. That's when Word of Mouth continues in just a minute.
Little darling, it's been a long, cold and lonely winter. Little darling, it feels like years since you've been here. Here comes the sun, little darling, here comes the sun.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. Today, my conversation with Joan Didion from Writers on a New England Stage, recorded at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Didion's new memoir is called Blue Nights, which continues her legacy of dissecting the pain of others, only this time Didion herself is the subject, reflecting on motherhood and the loss of her daughter.
You've interpreted so much of the world for us to this point.
Well, not clearly.
Really? You don't think? I mean,
no.
I even think these books about grieving have made people realize that their feelings of grief and that longing, this deep, deep inquiry has been meaningful for people.
That would be good. but I don't think necessarily.
Not the people who stop you in the airports and say, oh, you've made such a difference. You've really helped me through something. Do you not want the role? Is that what it is?
No, I like the role. I mean, the first time this happened to me in an airport, a young woman with a couple of children stopped me. And the children were kind of, you know, the way kids will pull away from you.
Right.
She was trying to hold on to them. They were twisting away. So she's twisting away, and meanwhile she's trying to convey to me how meaningful this book has been. It was magical thinking. And she said, I decided this book is better than marriage counseling. And I thought, I can't wish for more than that.
In that book, you talked a lot about a marriage. It was very much a book about a marriage. And now, as you mentioned, this becomes a book about aging. Did you see that happening? Did you become aware?
I saw it happening as I was. It started out being a book about having children, mm-hmm. and not having children, etc. And as it was moving along, there it got brisker at the point where it started to be about aging.
Mm-hmm. And you write about some of the what do you call sort of demoralizing and infantilizing treatment by doctors as you're trying to figure out what's wrong. You have this fear of falling, some neuropathy.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to admit, it was hard to imagine you working out. You had to go to physical therapy.
Yeah, I still do physical therapy 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm. Still with the same group of athletes that you meet in the book?
The New York Yankees. No, I'm not lucky enough to work out with the Yankees.
So tell us that story, because it's so funny.
A regular doctor told me that I ought to do some physical therapy, and he wrote a prescription out. So I took it into the physical therapy place at Columbia Presbyterian, and suddenly I saw the point in physical therapy, because I saw these other patients who were obviously getting something out of it. They had perfect balance. They had pretty much perfect everything as far as I could see. And I thought, well, if this can do this for them, what can it do for me? So I started working out 3 or 4 days a week with this group of other patients who came at the same time I did. It was 2 weeks before I discovered that they were the New York Yankees. who worked out at Columbia Presbyterian when they didn't have on their off days, you know. The only way I finally discovered it was that I was driving to the hospital one day, and there was a huge sign, a banner over in front of the hospital describing Columbia Presbyterian as the home of the Yankees.
Here's a question. Tell us how it feels to cross the bridges into New York City now, and perhaps how it feels to leave it.
I have no idea how it feels now because I've crossed those bridges so many times. So I have none of that sense of wonder that I had at a certain moment. I mean, the first time I think I wrote about this, the first time I ever crossed the bridges, I'd come in on an airplane, and it was like the second time I'd been on an airplane. I get on the bus, you know, they used to have a bus that brought you in from the airport, and it was pouring rain, and it's just so clear to me how irresistible it was and so beautiful. It doesn't look that way to me now. It looks different.
There's something from a teacher. She says, I teach high school English, and I tell my students that the form of essay informs all writing. Can you address this?
I don't know. The form of essay, in the same way the form of the novel affects, informs all. Once you make a form, it affects all writing, yes. But I'm not sure that the essay does so uniquely.
So we'll leave that to the high school class.
Let them tell me.
A lot of people are curious about how you spend your day.
Usefully.
No?
No. Today I spent my day on the train. Well, that was useful in that I got here.
Well, you're on a book tour talking about Blue Nights and the same for the Year of Magical Thinking. Was it therapeutic not just to write about the experience, but to talk about it in front of people, to talk about it with people?
Oh, I think it's always, I don't know what therapeutic means, but I think it's always useful to talk about something in front of people because you force yourself to put it into words, you know, find the words.
And you were forced to do that during the Year of Magical Thinking book tour while you were not quite, were you quite there with the grief?
No, I wasn't, in fact. I remember I was on a stage in San Francisco and simply started to cry. So no, I wasn't there with it at all. But on the other hand, it didn't hurt me.
I lost a younger brother 10 years ago. He was hospitalized for some time, and I remember the daily vigil of going to the hospital and thinking that you knew what you were up against. You know, you wanted...
Well, you never know in a hospital.
You don't.
Well, you could walk in. Every day you walk in, it's a different problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can remember walking in to hospitals. Quintana was in many of them. And hearing news that was totally new to me, you know.
Because she was hospitalized in New York and then also Los Angeles.
Then New York again.
But at least I had the sense that I knew while he was alive what we were up against. You know, that we wanted him to live. That was the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. How old was he when he died?
He was 35.
Oh.
It was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And he was a beloved brother.
Mm.
But after that death, the enemy was no longer there. Do you know what I mean? The broken man was no longer there.
Yeah, so I have a sense that I've always had that once you face something like that, you've looked at the rattlesnake. And that rattlesnake can't hurt you anymore. It can't jump out and get you anymore.
But then what does the fight become about?
Well, who knows? I presume something else will jump out.
Well, are you afraid of death?
No, I'm not afraid of death.
What are you afraid of? Anything?
Yes. I would just as soon feel better, frankly. I would just as soon not feel quite as fragile as I appear to be feeling at the moment.
How do you find your joy now?
Well, I still can, but I mean, how is different every day.
But you do.
But I do.
You have joy in your life. There's a photograph that I've seen often reprinted. It's of you and your husband and Quintana on a deck in Malibu. I think it's from the mid-70s, probably 76 or something. Mm-hmm. I think you're smoking.
I was,
had
yes.
a drink.
Yeah. You know what I discovered after?
What?
When I saw that picture printed, I hadn't realized it on the day that it was shot, that the photographer had been there earlier in the day, and they'd come back to get the late light. And then I look at the picture when it appears, and I realize that Quintana has taken advantage of this moment when he was gone and to put on eye makeup for the first time. So there we are.
I was always wondering about that photograph. I wanted you to describe it, and I guess I understand now. Is there a resonant memory of her, or are there just too many?
Too many.
Yeah.
Not too many for my purposes, but too many to describe.
Are you happy to have this book, Blue Nights, behind you?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Are you happy to talk about it on a book tour?
I'm not unhappy. I mean, it's very nice to be here.
Well, Joan Didion, it's so nice to have you here. I think a lot of people in the audience have been reading you for a long time and appreciating you for a long time. And I think this book brings us closer to you. And I want to really thank you for that.
Well, thank you. Thank you all.
Author Joan Didion, recorded live at the Music Hall for Writers on a New England Stage. Executive producer and live stage presentation director for the series is Patricia Lynch. NHPR's president is Betsy Gardella. This broadcast was produced by Word of Mouth senior producer Rebecca Lavoie. Associate producer and communications director is Margaret Talcott. Live sound and recording engineer is Mike Marchand. The musical director and band for the live stage show is Bob Lord and Dreadnought. Photography by David J. Murray of Clear Eye Photo. There's a link to see David's photos from the event at wordofmouthradio.org. If you'd like to hear interviews from the Writers on a New England Stage series, you can visit the Programs tab at nhpr.org. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.